Welcome, everyone. My name is Steve Ray, and this is December 1st, 2011, regular Thursday session of the Ontolog Forum. Today, we are very pleased to have Dr. Ramanathan Guha of Google, and accompanied by Dan Brinkley, who will be speaking about the schema.org activity. And just by way of introduction, I guess I'd just like to tell you how this sort of came about. And many in the past have accused me of being kind of an idealist or whatever, but my conviction is that, as we all know, ontologies cover a broad spectrum of formality, from anywhere, you know, first order logic kind of things at one end of rigor, all the way down to things that some people wouldn't even call an ontology, like just a tag system or a folksonomy, and everything in between, of course. My own personal feeling is that as we all are confronted with the challenge of and the desire to see ontologies used more in the mainstream, I believe. I think that unifies us all. My own feeling is that most of the, if you like, the bulk of society has to get there in baby steps. And I believe that, you know, what we see in a sort of the mass surge of the semantic web, so-called, is some sort of incremental steps toward formal ontologies. And it's kind of in that context that I see, and in fact I'm very excited to see, the activities of things like the schema.org come onto the horizon, which I think gets people thinking, at least in sort of metadata and structured ways, even if they're not writing first-order logic axioms and clauses today. And certainly with the Internet of Things and the machine-to-machine communications, I think this has a lot to offer getting it there. So it occurred to me that maybe we could see try and get the schema.org folks speaking in the Ontolog Forum, where we have then a diversity of sort of positions on this spectrum of formality of ontology, and just have a nice discussion about what schema.org folks are doing, where they see things headed, what their vision is, and then some, you know, good questions about how that fits into various people's views of ontology. So I'm hoping this will be a stimulating call, and I'm actually really looking forward to the discussion myself. So with that, I want to turn it over to Ramanathan Guha, known as Guha to most. By way of introduction, you all may know, you can look at his Wikipedia page. He got his degrees in IIT, Madras, Berkeley, and Stanford, and actually had some history with the psych. And Doug Linnett and folks was instrumental in fact, writing some of the representation languages for psych, and then got involved in some of the precursor work supporting the advent of RDF, Resource Description Framework. So I think obviously he comes with a good grounding in this kind of work, and I think a lot of us are anxious to hear about how he ended up pushing the schema.org work and landed at Google. So, Guha, if you'd like to take it away, we're just going to let you do your thing, and then when we open it up to Q&A, I'll try and manage the queue of questions as we go.
Great. Thank you, Steve. I also have with me today Dan Brinkley, who is working with Google, and he helps us manage our relationships with the standards communities and is actually the day-to-day shepherd of schema.org. Let me start off by giving a little bit of history about why we are doing something like schema.org. About 10, 15 years, 12 years ago, Tim Bray and I were working on this thing which became RDF, and the hope there was that webmasters, the web was growing very, very fast. It was growing by a factor of 10 every year, and the hope was that people would mark up their pages not just with display-related markup like, you know, H2 and H3 and so on and so forth, but also with markup which indicated you know, what are the kind of real-world entities they were talking about. You know, there's a particular page about Stanford, which is a university, and which had a, which was referring to a person called John McCarthy, and so on and so forth. We came up with the format, we came up with the syntax, we had a data model. It took a couple of years through the whole standards process, and we then thought vocabularies would appear and people would start using it. Unfortunately, they didn't. It just didn't quite catch on. There were a number of interesting articles, you know, Scientific American articles in the semantic web, and people thought we needed inferencing systems, and it got more and more and more complicated with OWL and things like that. But somehow it never caught on. It kind of went into a lull somewhere. I mean, I joined Google a while ago in 2005, and there was one very concrete application we were looking at, which is, you know, when somebody is looking at, you know, we have a set of search results, and associated with each search result is the title of the page and a little bit of text that we call a snippet, which tells the user sort of what to expect on the page based on which they can determine whether or not to click through. And they had the idea that if we could somehow get some structured data out of a page. So, for example, if you're looking at a page from Yelp or IMDb or Amazon or wherever, and you know that this page has, you know, 22 reviews and the average rating is, you know, 3.5 stars or something like that, that might give the user a better idea of what to expect when they click through to that page. And that's a useful thing. So we came up with some fairly straightforward, very simple things using non-standard kind of a way of doing things called microformats, and then we expanded it a little bit. And the interesting thing that happened was that this, having that data over there in the snippet, caused users to click more on those kinds of results because they had a better idea of what to expect, which in turn caused all these websites to go add this data to their pages. It was not a philosophical argument about you should go add this markup because it's a good thing for the web, etc. It was simply an economic decision. Over the next year and a half, we added about half a dozen more types of, you know, in addition to reviews, you know, some things about products and some things about people and so on and so forth, some things about recipes. And in each case, we saw fairly massive adoption by the community, community of websites, prominent websites, not community of standards people. at around the same time, or slightly before that actually, Yahoo did something similar with a product they have called Search Monkey. Google's impact was bigger simply because of market share issues and things like that. We decided that, okay, this whole strategy works, and it's a good thing for search. You know, it's we could write all kinds of fancy machine learning algorithms to figure out that an IMDb page, you know, Tom Cruise is an actor and Mission Impossible is a movie and so on and so forth. But in many cases, you know, the website has some kind of a database at the back end, and they take this database and put it into some form, some HTML, which loses the structure. What we really want access to is the backend database. In fact, we're kind of lazier than that. What we want access to is the backend database mapped to a standard vocabulary or a standard schema or what we would call an ontology, so that we could have this single coherent whole. It also became clear that if there were competing standards, people would just back off and not adopt any of them. So about a year, year and a half ago, we got together, and I spoke to the folks at Microsoft and then the folks at Yahoo and so on, to say that, look, this is an important thing and this is pre-competitive. We're not really competing with each other in the form of standards. What we do with the data is our own business. Let's get together and do this. It took about roughly 9 months to get a first cut of the basic ontology right. And numerous hours with lawyers and so on. It actually turns out to be a very complicated thing. We put out this thing called schema.org. The adoption has been pretty good. Something like now 1% of the sort of The web is, even Google doesn't exactly know how big the web is. But suffice it to say that it's at least a few hundred billion pages, and about a percent or more of the web now has this kind of schema.org markup, and it's growing very rapidly. And now that we have some kind of momentum, we're also expanding it out to other communities. So, for example, we work together with the IPTC, which is this consortium of news companies, including the BBC and AP and Reuters and New York Times and so on, to bring in something they call R News, which is a news-related vocabulary, into this fold. We worked with the White House to do some things related to veterans and jobs. There are a whole bunch of other communities who we are working with. We're also, back working again with the W3C, so that one of the big problems that turned out was that the kinds of markups that the semantic web community came up with, things like OWL and, the more complicated versions of RDF, you could tell webmasters to do it. The error rate, which is the number of times they marked up something which was either meaningless or which clearly did not say what the rest of their page said, is just too high for it to be consumable on a large scale. So we're working together with them to come up with something called RDF Lite, which will be hopefully a version where most of the common errors don't occur. That should be out in a few weeks, I believe, and Dan can add to that. So going forward, we hope to, also integrate this with good relations and a bunch of these other vocabularies having to do with things like scholarly publishing. The Gates Foundation and the Creative Commons folks are working on something having to do with marking up education resources. And over the next year, maybe we'll have 5 to 10 of these things. And we'll also come up with an extension mechanism whereby we can say that, look, we really don't, schema.org is going to focus on the vocabulary for the top 1-2% of things. And for the other things, we'll just sort of point to other standardized vocabularies and sort of refer people to those. And we need a formal mechanism for doing that. We're in the process of creating that as well. That's the high level of what we're trying to do. Our goal is not to create an AI. What we're trying to do is essentially create lots and lots and lots of ground atomic formula and do this on a scale which is basically hasn't been done before. We would like to create in many billions, ideally tens or hundreds of billions of triples, some of which will be public that we can share with others. Wikipedia is, for example, looking into marking up all their info boxes with this so that we can aggregate it and create a service where you can query it. There are some others who consider their data proprietary who will share it with search engines but don't want us to redistribute it. And clearly we can't do that. So the goal is, that's kind of our goal. Dan, do you want to add something?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I think just one tiny observation, which is a big part of democracy. There's all kinds of things we might like to do in terms of modeling, but if we do it, people will ignore us. It has to be just super, super simple. And that's probably the biggest constraint of all.
Okay, so at this point, do you want to just open it up for
Q&A? Yeah. I mean, I have no idea exactly what kinds of things people are interested in, and uh-huh. It could go all the way from what would it take to meld something like this with psych like thing, or all the way to exactly what are we thinking about,
Right. Okay. Well, I will try and manage the list of questions, and Peter Benson has jumped in there quickly right off the bat. So, Peter, if you want to make sure you do the *7 to unmute your phone and then test out your voice, I'll tell you if I can hear you.
Steve, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Okay, go ahead.
This is probably more of a, there's lots of parallel universes out there, as we all know. It'd be nice if they also came together, in a big bang and we can get on with everything. But where we've been working for several years with the Defense Department, NATO, and all the big buyers on a common cataloging system, open source, which is has spawned two international standards. One is ISO 8000, which is the standard for data quality, and the other is ISO 22745, which is for the exchange of characteristic data. Now, they're based on a common terminology in a massive open technical dictionary. So 22745 defines what is an open technical dictionary, and it's basically a collection of concepts, classes, properties, units of measures, everything you think of, but the tags are basically open, public domain identifiers, and there's a common resolution between it. So I've just looked at the schema.org, and of course the properties that you have, most of those are there. The difference maybe is there's lots of people use that open technical dictionary to declare equivalences. You're using that tag or that concept. I'm using this one, but I think it's the same thing. So they actually use the dictionary to build equivalences, mapping solutions effectively. So there may be something that may be helpful in what we've been doing to what you've been doing. The current technical dictionary has over 1.9 million concepts registered already. And it's in, I think, 28 languages. So it's really just a repository of terminology without any attempt to create hierarchies or structures. It's just, here's a term and here's a definition. And it gives it a public domain identifier so that I can reference that when I communicate with somebody, because tags are very are tough to communicate with. Jerry Raddick, who's on the call, Dr. Raddick is actually the editor of those two standards and is one of the architects of the actual dictionary itself. So he may be able to give you some more background to it. But I think there would be a great benefit of from the dictionary side, making sure that all of your terminology is at least published through the dictionary. That's pretty easy to do. But there may be, as you are exploring other concepts and you're bringing other concepts into your schema, you may want to check and see how those have been defined in that dictionary and where they came from.
Yeah, that's a really good suggestion. We should do that.
I mean, it's what you typically find in that dictionary is the terminology from all the NATO terminology, of course, because that's where it started, but then all the IEC, ISO, a lot of the national and international standards. The OTD has been collecting together all of that terminology and making it available to everybody. So I'd like to talk to you offline, probably after this call, if we have some time to show you what that looks like, and I'm sure we could leverage the two together.
Sure, we could figure out something. This is the thing. Our thing is not so much defining the vocabulary. Our thing is to make sure that the vocabulary stays general and small, and we're engaged in this trade-off where we needed to be able to make all the distinctions we would like it to make, while at the same time being sufficiently easy for a webmaster to. I mean, most of the people almost all the people who we deal with who mark up these pages don't care diddly squat about ontology, and they couldn't distinguish between, or they don't care about the distinction between ontology and oncology.
Correct.
And so it has to be very simple, very understandable, and they need cookie cutter, but they are the ones who are sitting on all the interesting data.
The way that the dictionary works is this core dictionary is just a dictionary, like a Webster or any of the other, La Russe, any other dictionary, just concepts. The only difference is it gives each of the individual concepts an identifier. So cap, thing I wear on my head, explosive device, and bottle closure have different identifiers. They use the same term, hopefully have different definitions. So that's all it does. But what also happens is I notice in looking at your schemas, we call those data requirements. What is the data required to define an individual in your context? So when we look at the schemas you have here, we recognize those as, and I'm looking on my screen here, thing, person, and this basically tells me these are the properties that you have said you need to define a person. And different people have different schemas of how they want to define a person. This is yours. all we're concerned about is it would be nice if the concepts, right, such as death date, right, were consistent across everybody. So I may or may not collect that information in my scheme of person, but if I am going to do it, it would be nice if I use the same concept identifier. And that's really how those standards work. Really simple.
Yeah.
And they've been applied very widely. There's hundreds of millions, I know in your language that's pretty small, but hundreds of millions of things, people, places, organizations, and goods and services that have been defined using that language already.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, let me pick up after this, and then,
All right. Yeah, let's move on. In fact, let me just follow up on that really briefly. Just my impression is that the schema.org is more of a taxonomy. It's a tree structure rather than an ontology with associations and relations between the concepts. Is that right, Guha?
Well, schema.org has a taxonomy, but the primary purpose of schema.org is think of it almost as documentation, which says that, look, if you're going to mark up something about a movie, here is the markup. If you're going to mark up something about a local business, here is the markup. We arrange the terms in a taxonomy so as to try and kind of make it comprehensible. But most users of the taxonomy are webmasters. Most users of schema.org are webmasters who don't really care very much about the taxonomy. They care about one or two types, and they restrict their attention to those types.
Mm-hmm. So your plans aren't to start codifying the relations between the concepts rather than just having essentially a subclass tree, is that correct?
No, we have a huge number of relationships between concepts. In fact, that's the interesting thing. We don't actually care about the tree, like, you know, actor is a specialization of person, which is a specialization of legal agent, we don't care so much about that. We care more about, well, actors act in movies, and movies have directors and actors and producers and things like that. So we're actually interested in that graph, not so much in the typology, if you will.
You're trying to harmonize them with things like FOF or Veldenkor or whatever. Is that correct?
Yeah, insofar as it makes sense.
Okay.
I mean, if you just look at the numbers, there's two ontologies, if you want to call them, two vocabularies which are used, which account for about 99.5% of the markup on the web today. One is schema.org and its predecessor family, and the other is the Open Graph protocol from Facebook. And the rest you have to search for. And so we don't want to necessarily – so our policy has been that we will derive from the existing work, we will give it credit, but the cost of giving it credit, giving them credit, should not be passed on to webmasters who have to do the markup.
Okay. Okay, we have Ken Goodyear on the queue then with a question. Ken, you want to do a test voice test?
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
My question really is, from a Google perspective, how is this going to interrelate with AdWords?
It's going to. Unfortunately, I really can't talk about it. It's our, we don't talk about future product plans.
But it will.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you tell us more about particular terms and particular things, it would be stupid not to make use of that.
Okay.
And AdWords and AdSense and all that stuff, right? I mean, it's
okay.
It's not that I'm trying to hide anything from you. We're still trying to figure out what this all means.
I understand. I'm just kind of curious. You know, it's an obvious good fit.
It's an obvious good fit, and we also have to be very careful about how we do it otherwise. I mean, you have no idea about the size of this. There are people who are, there's this whole entire small industry, which is, worth several billion dollars in turnover, called the SEO industry, search engine optimization. And the newest thing among search engine optimizers is to help you mark up your site with schema.org markup. And the most amusing thing was that I get this email to, I have the web domain goha.com, and I get this email to my goha.com thing saying, let us help you mark up schema.org with schema.org markup so that your Google ranking can improve. And this is like out of control. So we just have to be very, very careful because for better or worse, we just have one hammer and it's a very large hammer.
Okay. Thank you for answering.
Okay. So Guha, would you care to speculate on where you think this is going to be headed? In other words, what might this evolve into over the next several years, how you think the schema.org approach will evolve.
I don't know how the schema.org, I mean, I would like it to be the case that at some point schema.org just is one of those things, a set of vocabularies that lots and lots of people use on the web. And the more interesting thing is what's the next generation of applications that it enables, right?
Mm-hmm.
And let me give you an example of RSS. We did the RSS at Netscape way back when. Our hope then was that, if we would consider it a success, if there were like 200, maybe even 1,000 or 5,000 RSS feeds in the world,
mm-hmm.
that would be huge. And we knew that something really interesting was happening when about 2-3 weeks after we launched RSS, the Mormon Church announced its RSS feed. It was like, whoa. I mean, we thought New York Times and BBC, maybe a few others, but the Mormon Church. And now it's the last time I asked somebody in one of the appropriate teams at Google, they said they're like, well, it's about 50 million plus RSS feeds. And it's used for all kinds of things from, Linux package manifests to God knows what else. So that's the kind of, if you have structured data, you're going to find all kinds of applications. And there's a symbiotic relationship between the applications and the direction this thing goes in and back and forth.
Okay. All right, so sort of your vision seems to me, from what I'm hearing you say, is the whole idea of an extensible platform which could go in a number of directions, which hard to anticipate until we see where people
think. Yeah, and in fact, if it doesn't go in unexpected directions, we've not given it enough degrees of freedom.
Right. Let me proxy for John Soa, who wanted to be on the call today, but was unable to. He had other commitments, but I'll try and paraphrase an email he had sent to the Ontolog forum. He basically was asking a question of you, Guha, which was, gee, back in 1998, when you were working on the RDF, I guess that was when you were doing the RDF stuff, why didn't you just choose a nice simple notation like Lisp with, triples and n-tuples? I can put some of this on the chat board, but... And he said that way you could just use simple things like if-then rule for a horn clause logic, similar to data log for reasoning, instead of going with Sparkle or those kinds of things, and bind to SQL for storing or treating, much as some of these, of course, Sparkle gateways work. And his final sentence here was, this logic and its expression in a Lisp-like notation could be presented in a very readable 10-page manual. It would be much easier to teach, learn, and use than current STEM web offerings. It could be used in conjunction with any kind of database technology you like, relational, object-oriented, RDFA tags, and web pages, and support a nice natural growth. So his question really was, why didn't you go that way back in 1998, and why did you not want to consider going that way today?
Falls into the old wounds. I would have liked to do that. For better or worse, the world was in the W3C. We're in love with angle brackets. XML was the rage then, and there are certain, when you often... It's nice to be able to say, look, this is my field, and you have to play in it the way I want you to play in it, otherwise don't play. Unfortunately, that's not how standards work, and everybody has to kind of agree, and otherwise you're just off in your own world. And the rules were it has to be in XML, it has to be embeddable inside HTML, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in terms of the syntax, the same kind of thing applies today. We did insist on certain things like, certain kinds of cleanliness and certain kinds of simplifications, when it came to the actual schema and the vocabulary, but in terms of the syntax, we still have similar constraints. It's kind of sad, but I completely agree with John. I wish we could have done that. Dan Rickley, who was on many of the phone calls in those days, on the RDF phone calls, can attest to my wailing and pleading with people to make it simple.
Okay.
And the original select for RDF, by the way, was 2 pages. And then we somehow ended up with a process where the primer for RDF is 100 pages.
Right.
Yeah. If you go back into history, one of the other ancestors of RDF was the PIX language, the Platform for Internet Content Selection. And that, in 95, 96, 97, that was using S expressions.
Yeah.
And one of the proposals to elaborate that into a markup into RDF was PIX Next Generation. And again, that was using S expressions. And then this explosion happened, which was XML. And really, after that, you just had to use XML with XML fever.
Mm-hmm. All right, fair enough. So, pragmatic recognition of where the market's going.
To be honest, it's mostly fad. And there was not even an iota of XML at that point on the web, and people just said XML is going to change the web, is going to change everything from databases to X and Y and Z, and you know, there was hype feeding on itself. So basically, yeah.
Okay, they didn't have
to. We're in agreement on that one. That's okay, Leo, you have your hand up. Want to test your voice? We don't hear you yet. Try any numerous phone-based or dial-pad-based, *7, local mute. No. Not hearing you, Leo. I'll tell you what. Let me jump over to Peter Yim for the moment, and then when you think you've got the unmute working, we can get back to you. So, Peter?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yep, yeah, got you.
All right. So, thank you very much for the briefing. It's inspiring. And obviously, even the names, I mean, like RV, Guha, Tim Bray, Dan Brickley, I mean, inspires, or because I mean, you guys have consistently been able to gain traction when huge organizations don't.
Oh, thank you.
So, I mean, looking back...
We have text calls when we beat our head against the wall.
Looking back, I mean, maybe individually, I mean, Guha and Dan, I mean, what do you think made the difference? Why are you gaining traction when others aren't? What did you do right?
Not sure that I would say I have gained traction. Most of the things I've done haven't gained traction. There's just two things. One is that I keep, you know, you keep throwing enough, keep buying enough lottery tickets, you eventually win. And so I keep trying things. And the second one is that it's got to be really, really, really simple value proposition for gaining traction. You know, you do this, you get that. So taking RDF, it didn't get traction because there was no simple value proposition. It was something which was should have been targeted at webmasters. Instead, it was targeted at other standards practitioners. RSS, there's never even there's questions about the history of RSS because we never bothered to publish a formal spec. It was just a blog post this is before blog posts. It was just some documentation page. And yet the value proposition was so painfully clear. You do this, and then somebody can come into their mind Netscape and add your module to their mind Netscape so that they can see your offering every day. And everybody, it's a very clear value proposition. Similarly, with schema.org, the value proposition is very clear, which is that you add this markup to your web page, and you will get another 3, 4, 5, maybe even 8, 9% more traffic because people will click on your Google search results more. That's about, it's persistence and common sense.
Mm.
Maybe Dan has the magic formula, I don't know.
I guess its career formula is following Guha's footsteps for the most part. I will echo the simplicity thing. So when I look at the two RDF vocabularies I've had most connection to that have got adoption, that's the friend of a friend thing and SCOS in the library world, they're kind of boringly simple. It's not a lot to them. So I think because of that, a lot of people in the more formal end of the ontology community have not found them interesting. But it is that simplicity that allows people to just pick it up and use it. People don't read documentation. So, for example, in the photo spec, for a while we had a property called Score Homepage. and as an English guy, school for me is obviously, you know, the thing you go to until you're 18. And then what we found was Americans were using it to include their college. And you know, whatever you put in the documentation, whatever you put even in the formal ontology, it's going to be completely ignored. And people, if you're lucky, will read the name of the property they're using. Sometimes they don't even do that. So if you want large-scale adoption, you kind of have to hold your nose.
Okay, let's try again.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Okay, yeah, I was using the old phone system keys, I think. Thank you. This is very useful. My question mainly is, when we began this process, maybe you mentioned this at the beginning of the talk, which I missed. In the past, I know the argument's been that really bag of words kind of searching that Google does and others mainly do was really sufficient for, you know, almost everyone's needs. And therefore, semantic search, you know, is kind of downplayed. Well, this is not really, it's going towards semantic search. It's more like a, you know, structural vocabulary-based search. But my question is, did you really see that the previous approach or the current approach, the bag of words approach, was not really precise enough for certain cases, let's say structured data?
So, for starters, a caveat, I have no idea what semantic search means. It's been used so many
right.
times. In fact,
we
go, if you notice, the word semantic is not used on schema.org website. It is the most abused word of the computer science community. Having said that, from day one, Google is well beyond the bag of words model. Everything from PageRank, anchor text, I mean, pretty much every web search engine today goes well, well beyond what you'd consider the bag of words model. They have, you know, they have n-grams and anchor text and static rank and dynamic rank and this and that. And so it's a huge number of signals go into it. And adding to the kind of data that we can throw, that structured markup or communicating markup, this kind of structured data gives, plays together with that. It's not a this or that. It's most technology companies are very polytheistic. They'll use whatever works, and Google is even more like that than most other companies. We just need it to be scalable. That's all. We can't afford to go mark up things on a page by page basis. It just needs to work for millions or billions of pages at a time.
Okay, thank you. A slight follow-on is that do you in the early results that you've seen, I mean, you expressed that Webmaster see 8 to 9% more traffic.
No, anywhere from a few percent. I mean, it's basically like we have to provide enough value to the users so that they prefer these kinds of results, so that we have to create the ecosystem. And the ecosystem starts with providing greater value to the users so that they click on it, which causes webmasters to go do the work, and then the positive cycle is reinforced. We can't just cause people to click on things. You know, it's only in a sustainable fashion. We have to provide that additional value.
Okay.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Let's move on. We got Nicola Guarino from Italy. Try your voice. Let's see if we can test that. Not hearing you yet, Nicola. Nope.
*7.
*7, yeah. Okay, let me do the same time-saving trick here, and we'll jump over you, Nicola, for the time being, but feel free to... I'll get back to you right after the next question, which is Ali Hashemi. Ali, are you on an audible?
Can you guys hear me?
Yes, indeed.
Perfect. I have two questions. First, I guess it's how necessary do you guys think RDF is to the success of linked data? Is it important to link data? Can people ignore it? What are your feelings towards it?
This is what a question for Dan, but let me give you my 2 bits. I think we need some vocabulary, some standard way of marking up things. There is nothing particular about RDF which makes it magical, but given that, you know, schema.org and that, therefore the major search engines and all are going to be using, you know, recognizing it, and there is already a large suite of tools and things like that, it will probably, at least RDFA, is probably here to stay. There's two parts of the linked data thing, which is stuff which is embedded on web pages and stuff which is used in things like, you know, Google has this effort called linked sets or open data sets or something like that. That uses some other syntax. It's a syntax. It doesn't matter. That's my attitude. Dan?
I think there's a lot of fiddly details in the RDF specs, which you could flip a coin on and take in a slightly different direction. I think probably the most interesting question is whether something more or less like RDF is needed. Could it be, instead of binary relations, NRE relations? And to be honest, I don't know. I think when you look at people trying to use RDF, they always come back with the same complaints, that it's too restrictive. They want to say extra things about the link between X and Y. And I could certainly see room for improvement there. The basic graph-shaped data,
okay,
I think,
thanks.
Is quite inspiring.
Oh.
People like it.
Ollie, you had a second question?
I agree.
Question?
Yeah, I don't know to what extent you guys can actually talk about this, but how do you evaluate the trust or validity in the markup of the web pages that you're seeing?
So there's two parts. I mean, schema.org really is like these four companies now, which I can say we all recognize as markup. And because between the three companies, three of the four, Yandex is the fourth one, we have such an overwhelming share of the market, search market, that we can't really talk about what we're going to do with the data. So we don't actually talk about it in schema.org. But as Google, essentially we do all the things. I mean, you could... There's a thing, for example, called cloaking. A lot of websites, when Google comes to it, will give, you know, when the Google give the Google crawler a version of their page, and when the user comes to it, they'll give a different version of the page with more ads and this and that and pop-ups and all that stuff. That's called cloaking. If you found cloaking, they'll remove you from our index. Over a period of time, we figured out all kinds of ways of identifying cloaking. We do, and we have, you know, we do similar things over there for, to make sure, to identify spam and other non-trustworthy things with structured data markup. Nothing, I mean, fundamentally, it's, we don't see it as being very different from other kinds of untrustworthy behavior on the web. It is a huge problem. I mean, things like this, I don't know if you guys have been following, there's this whole thing called content farms where they found that, look, if you can get somebody to a page, if you can get about 10, 50 page views on a page, you can expect to make a buck off it. And if you can get people to write an article in about, you know, copy and paste from other sources, especially Wikipedia, and to plaster together an article, in about 2 minutes, then you could have essentially a farm of part-timers who just bam, 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 produce articles. Now, most of these things really aren't worth reading. And they're not spam. They're not, I mean, it's really, it's the bottom feeders and there's huge amounts of the stuff that is being created. And we are trying to come up with ways of identifying it. And it's really hard because these are beautifully constructed sentences. They're grammatically correct. And you read through it. You read through half of it, and you realize, I've gone through half of this thing, and the sentences aren't logically connected to each other. They are, doesn't make doesn't hang together, and you realize it's been like quasi-generated by pulling together sentences, existing sentences, making some modifications, and slamming it together. Right now, you're talking about requiring close to, real AI to be able to identify that this does not hang together and things like that. And so, those are the kinds of issues we have to deal with.
Hmm. So, Dan Brinkley, did you want to, I noticed you put a whole discussion sort of on the chat responding to the RDF requirement. Did you want to say anything following up on that?
No, I was just
recording.
Analyzing.
Okay. So, I wanted to move back to the original or earlier comment about adoption and things. And what I thought you were going to say on that question of what did you do right and certain things is the very fact that Google and Microsoft, Bing and Yahoo all did a little bit of marketing, if you like, publicity about schema.org, which is something that typically, you know, standards bodies don't do. And I'm presuming that was part of your strategy to try and see if this could get some more traction. Would you agree?
Actually, no. Trust me, we do publicity, et cetera, for lots and lots of things. And 90% of those things don't catch on. After the marketing has died out, and after, I mean, the marketing is there to basically let people know this is there,
uh-huh.
and then they have to decide. So there's two, three things. One is if people don't ever find out that there is great value, then they won't do it. So you have mm-hmm. to figure out a way of letting them know. The second thing is, after they find out it's there, they have to decide. Whether they're going to invest the X hours required to make their site, add this markup to their site. And that's a pure value proposition. If they see a value, they'll do it. If they don't see a value, it doesn't matter how good your marketing is, they won't.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this is not an impulse buy, like drinking a Coke or something like that. It's a bigger,
right.
more substantial investment. And for that, you really have to deliver the value.
Well, where I was sort of headed, actually, is a conviction I have that as much as the World Wide Web is a wonderful thing for people, it seems to me that one of the huge business propositions in the future for economic benefit is the Internet of Things. In other words, machine-to-machine or device-to-device communications, which is necessarily going to have to be more structured and rigorous, because those devices don't have the common sense that people have. So I was and that, quite honestly, is one reason I'm really big on ontology for sharing information is not so much for sharing it between people, but rather between devices or things. What are your thoughts on that, first of all?
I mean, there is a lot of it going on already, right? When your travel agent makes a booking reservation, there are computers that are talking to each other, which have a very specific semantics about various codes and this and that and so on and so forth. What we're talking about here is what McCarthy would call generality, which is, can we come up with a single extensible sort of elaboration tolerant language which can be used for all of these things. That's a hope, but systems that succeed are not necessarily systems that do best in their optimal state, but systems that are best at evolving. And
mm-hmm.
so what we are trying to do is take that path. Eventually, I don't know when, it would be nice if we had such a common vocabulary. But in the meantime, if I could get that little rating about that restaurant that Yelp has and help somebody there, that's a way to go.
Okay, so you're still on the path of human users as essentially, as you say, the webmasters for pages that people are looking at rather than structures for devices or systems or things like that.
If there is an application that is the point I'm making is that at every step of the way, if you ask, at this point in time, it's still humans who are doing the programming. And if you ask them to do it, they'll say, why should I do it? And for them, you have to show them what value there is. And if there are applications which where we can show value. And the problem in many of these applications is that there's already existing standards and things like that. They may be narrow, but they already exist. And so it's very difficult to supplant them. So if you can show value, people will do it. And that's kind of the realm of it.
Okay. All right.
And I'm hoping that, you know, down the road this will, I mean, the web was never meant to be the kind of, nobody ever thought in 92, 93, 94 that the web was going to be so all-encompassing, right? It's because it kept evolving, so.
Right. I mean, that's right. I was going to jump on you when you said it was never meant to that, but anyway, yes, I agree that no one imagined it.
Yeah.
But as even I know that, you know, Vint Cerf at Google working with the smart grid, and there's all kinds of other things being dreamed up for the web as far as information exchange beyond web pages that people are looking at. So
yeah,
that's kind of where I was headed. But okay, let me cede the floor here to the next questioner, Arnaud.
Yes, hi.
I can hear you. Go ahead.
So this is Arnaud Lewis from IBM. I have a question for Gua in terms of the governance of schema.org at this point. I understand that there is progress has been made in bringing some of the discussion into the directory with a public forum, but when it comes to deciding what ends up being adopted in schema.org, who has the final word?
It's the member, the sponsors, Microsoft, Google, Yahoo, and Yandex.
And so you intend to keep it that way?
Yeah. I mean, otherwise, there is too much of a history of camels being designed by committees in standards bodies. And at this point in time, the schema.org is not even a formal organization. There is no, it's just a website. And there's a weekly phone call and a bunch of people who get together and say, okay, fine, we can all do this, and we'll support it in this kind of a time frame, and we go do it. And it moves very fast, very quickly. Pretty much all decisions till now have been, you know, have been unanimous. There's a couple of outstanding invitations to other companies. But other than that, you know, that's it.
Can I comment on that?
Yes, please.
So I probably spent most of my career around standards, and much as I love standards, I think it's a good way to start a sentence. Much as I love standards, committees are better at certain kinds of things than other kinds of things. They're better at focused problems that have nice, clear, obvious answers. When you have a product like schema.org, whose scope runs from, you know, we have Volcano in there, we have Hairdresser in there, it's terrifyingly broad scope. Sometimes the decisions have to be arbitrary. They have to be ugly. Again, you have to hold your nose sometimes. But the more important thing is that we have a decision and we record it. And having a piece of work with such a broad scope in an essentially democratic environment, I think, would be pretty horrible. There would be very little chance of consensus. There would be discussions that drag on for months and years. You know, we're looking at RDF now, still being finished, and the RDF design began in 1997. And that's not because the people involved are stupid or because the companies and organizations involved are malicious. Committee work takes a long time. And I think for schema.org, I'm personally happy to sacrifice a bit of democracy for a bit of moving faster. I hope that doesn't sound too cold-blooded. It's more important that we get something out there, even if it's a bit ugly. I think the piece of governance that is interesting that we should put some more attention to is long-term preservation. As we start talking to national libraries and governments and museums about adopting schema.org, one of the things you hear back from them is, you know, will it still be there in 5 years' time? Will it still be there in 10 years' time? And I'd like to put mechanisms in place such that if the collaboration between Google, Yahoo, Bing, Yandex, whoever, does go stale, that it gets kind of frozen, archived, put into a position where the documentation survives. And I think that's much more important than having everybody vote on everything.
I agree with that. I mean, it's the AOL stopped support for RSS about 6 months after it bought Netscape, but the standard itself survived somehow. And we'll make sure, I mean, we'll make sure that happens with the schema.org.
This is Steve Ray again. Actually, it's an interesting observation you make, Dan, on the standards world, I'm also sort of a standards person for many years, I'll offer an additional reason that sometimes one might not want to go to committee as early, and that actually has to do with the process specification language that Michael Gruninger was editor for when he was at NIST with me. We intentionally, in fact, he and some others worked on the PSL specification outside of a committee. In fact, before even deciding which committee to take it to, for reasons of integrity. Now that was quite a different reason from just getting it out there. It was a reason of trying to craft something that could be thought about and built very carefully before taking it to a committee to then have the whole consensus process take over. And I would say that one worked. The PSL as a first order logic standard has a lot of consistency about it that might not have been possible had we built it in committee. But now it is a standard. Okay. Any other questions? There's no queue right now. I will volunteer the fact that one of my motives of asking Guha to have this session was to also air the idea we're right in the middle of discussing what kinds of themes might be considered for the Ontology Summit this next spring. And I was kicking around the possibility ideas of whether something in terms of what the formal ontologist and the pragmatic ontologist might be able to do to help one another. So I'm just throwing that out there for people to think, and I was considering whether or not the schema.org groups might be interested in linking arms in that regard.
I can't talk about I can't talk for all the others, and on this one I'd have to get all the others to agree as well. I can float the idea by them again.
I recognize what you just said, which is the fact that the schema.org group, an informal group, can move very quickly, get things done, might not be predisposed to have a, you know, long...
In fact, even if you ask the folks, some of the folks who participate, on the calls every week, they're like, what, formal ontology? Do we have anything to do with that? How is that related to what we're doing? They see themselves more as sort of web database people.
Yeah. Of course, I think that line will blur as time goes on.
The line is already blurred in many ways, but there's a certain very practical approach.
Indeed. Okay. Ali, you have another question?
I just wanted to point to Nicola posted his question into the chat. I didn't actually have one myself. I just wanted to point to that. Should we do that one?
Wait, you wanted to point us to his follow-up?
At the bottom of the chat.
Oh, the Nicola Guarino's question. Okay, let me just try and read it out loud here for people. The reason why super simple ontologies like FOF work is that the words are simple to understand, but there are words which everybody understands and words that are ambiguous and difficult to define or explain. With a few examples. It's a fact that people doing markup don't care about deep semantics of their tags. So if the goal is to get billions of pages marked up, that's fine. But what about using these marked up pages for information integration, service mashup, and so on instead of just search, which was kind of what I was talking about in terms of the Internet of Things. Bottom line, extensive tagging with little semantics may be very useful for search, but not for integration of information. That is underlying my comments about the future, I think, of Internet of Things as well. It's going to be hard.
Let me actually make a point over there, which is I think there is an assumption made in this question, which is that there is such a thing as deep semantics and shallow semantics, and further that there is such a thing as application-independent semantics. Over the years, you know, I spent a considerable portion of my life working on psych, which was started on that assumption. Maybe there's some truth to it, but it's not black and white. You can define your information integration task, and we could come up with a schema for that, I can then, based on that, go define a different integration task for which the schema that you have defined is ambiguous and not adequate. And in part of the problem with various vocabulary standards, efforts, and so on and so forth, is that if they try to do something which is completely application independent, they end up with such incredibly complicated vocabularies which want to make every single distinction that is possible, that it becomes unusable for most things. I would much rather be like the web itself, where it started off with some really simple things. I want a list of items. Okay, fine. In the moment when the web was being done, you had the HTML community which was deriding it, saying, ah, but you will never be able to do X and Y and Z. What we really need is this markup and a styling system and a this and a that. And, you know, I mean, they're still talking about all that stuff. And what really succeeded was this really dirt stupid, dirt silly things, except you could add more to it. You know, you had Eric Bina, who had no knowledge of HTML and all that stuff, said, well, I want, in the history of Eric Bina's, of addition of tables, is, and recent came to Eric Bina one day and said, look at that AOL homepage, which was not on the web, by the way, which was their find, and says, I need to be able to make a web page look as beautiful as that and do that layout. And he figured, well, you need rectangular blocks and you define something called tables, and he did it. And then the next thing happened, and the next thing happened, and the next thing happened. We went through periods of extreme ugliness, but then, you know, it keeps moving. You know, you have HTML5, and you have this, and you have that, and it'll keep changing for the next 10 years. I would much rather have a system like that than one which, on day one, a bunch of people get together and say, we are going to do deep semantics for the ultimate application, which will make all the distinctions. We've been there, done that, doesn't work.
Hmm.
I'm sorry if it's a little harsh, but I mean, it's like I spent 8 years of my life building that thing, and I actually didn't do... I mean, I built Psychel, I did the Psych Upper Ontology, I can tell you all the distinctions. I've written a book on the distinction between stuff and individual and, you know, and all that other stuff. And, you know, it's like Montague semantics versus, you know, the other one, and so on. It's just most people don't get it, and it doesn't.
Yeah.
And at the end, you find it's not enough.
Mm-hmm. You'll never get those 8 years back.
I won't get those 8 years back.
I'm interested to see there's no hands going up with some of those, as some of the people on the list certainly have also dedicated their lives to some quote-unquote deep semantics. But, well, Leo, you have your hand up. Did you want to comment?
Yes, sorry. Dr. Gua. I understand being, you know, kind of bottom-up, pragmatically driven, and that's extremely important. But in many applications, you do need precision, and you do need precise semantics, even, you know, at a very low-level domain theory level. But what we also find, at least we tend to find, I think, is that when you come together with other communities and other domains, and you have to integrate your domain representation, however simple it was to you and satisfied your needs, that you end up kind of, in effect, doing an integration ontology between your two. You could call it a schema initially, but, you know, in some sense it's maybe a simple ontology or vocabulary, but when you come together, you end up doing an integration ontology, which can be as almost as complex as the individual domain theory ontologies. And then when you do this across the board, so you have multiple enterprises and communities and, you know, even the same domains but with different perspectives, things grow and grow. And so one of the arguments for strata in the ontology levels, like foundational ontologies and mid-level ontologies, is that they represent spanning concepts. They can emerge over time, bottom-up, but typically they have to emerge for sharing of information across the, you know, larger and larger realms. So you know, I'd like you to comment on that if you can.
I agree. I mean, I should be careful. I didn't say that deep ontologies are ontologies with precise definitions of the terms are bad. They are required, absolutely required. What I'm saying is that when you're creating an ontology, have at least one application in mind. If you try to create ontologies for the ultimate application, which will be there, etc., these things tend to be too complicated and nobody ever uses them. In terms of layering is absolutely right. We should do it, and we are in schema.org. We're looking at various kinds of extension mechanisms which allow for layering and things like that. My only point was, like, having spent so many years trying to do sort of the ultimate correct thing, systems that evolve tend to be more biological, more analogous to biological systems. Things which kind of grow, because at every step of the way there is sort of this evolutionary path that nudges it that way. And in the world we are talking about, the evolutionary path as well, there's an application which wants this, so you extend it, and so on and so forth. I and schema.org proponents would much rather have sort of the success problem of, you know, unveil the messy web rather, which is sort of after 15, 20 years is still growing faster than ever, rather than the clean but sterile and not growing world of many competing alternate systems.
Or maybe not growing quite as fast, yes.
Yeah.
All right.
Can I jump in here quickly with the example?
Sure.
If you look at the kind of conversations happening around schema.org about extensions, they all overlap terribly. So we have this collaboration with the job search thing Guha mentioned earlier, describing jobs, adverts for jobs, people's possible careers. The natural part of that is describing areas of expertise and specialism. There's a parallel discussion we're having with the Creative Commons guys and the LRMI on learning resources, so things that can help you learn and come out of the educational sector. And again, there's similar needs
there. To give another example, when you're talking about news articles, they often want to specify a geographical box around where the news is about, and at the same time, you're talking to some of the geo and mapping people who are much more in the geo area. And we have all these overlaps, and we pragmatically kind of deal with these things. But at each step, our main constraint that we've imposed on ourselves is that at every step of the way, or every few steps, we have to be able to show measurable value to webmasters. Otherwise, we end up with the equivalent of the 100-page RDF primer, which nobody's interested in reading.
Yeah. And because we're dealing with existing data sets, if we decided on a one true vocabulary that captured all of us, it's no good unless it maps to what people actually have in their database. So our hands are tied.
Interesting. Okay. Well, let's see. A couple more questions popping up here. James Soras, do you want to test your voice? Let's see if we can hear you. Can't hear you at this point, so *7 on your keypad to unmute your phone.
Hello?
Yeah, got you now.
Hello? Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is Jim Soracci. How do you do?
Good, thank you.
I'm not a computer scientist. I'm a physician in health and human services, but I do follow some of this from afar. And I really had two or three sort of observational comments and questions. One being that in my experience, I've found a lot of people are asked to code things in healthcare, and the level of coding granularity seems to be associated with miscoding. So it's difficult for people to go into a lot of codes and actually find one that's correct.
Yes.
And the available literature actually shows that even in a carefully controlled white coat environment, people don't select the same code for the same patient and the same health history. So, you know, I'm always sort of curious about finely coded ontologies. I've also looked into issues of validation of ontologies. And it appears to me that as they get more complex, it becomes more difficult to validate them in any way, and that they can frankly have errors in them, and you transit them in many unpredictable ways. So every time you get an answer, you end up having to figure out whether it's accurate. The third thing I'd say, and it attracted my attention a couple of this summer, was an article in ACM, that Communications of ACM, that was basically discussing strategies and integration, information retrieval or search strategies with basic database queries. And I've often been wondering if that isn't something that could be more formally studied. And the fourth thing I'll say, and I'll just sign off here, is we've actually tried to interpret, like, comorbidities in the Medicare population, like how many people have more than one disease. And to get sensible, there are 15,000 ICD-9 codes in the claims billing database. To get interpretable patterns, we had to throw out 12,000 of them and roll the remaining 3,000 up into 70 high-level diseases. Otherwise, everybody became unique, and we couldn't find our way out of the forest. So I'll just leave those as sort of general. And I've come away thinking that really we do need ontologies that are developed. I'm not anti-ontology, but we need multiple simple ontologies that are developed by true domain experts, and that it's a flaw to try to unify them into an Uber swan. Is sort of where I am in my thinking. And so I'll yield the floor here. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I mostly agree with you. And
Okay. Yeah, I think that is true. I agree too. Roger Cutler, you're on the queue.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Yeah.
Okay, first, let me apologize if I'm asking you to repeat something, because I've been on and off because of communication problems. But I'd be interested in information about what kind of adoption schema.org has had. I did some searching using Google, I might add, and I found very little about that except from Drupal, and at least from Drupal, the adoption seemed to be incredibly tiny, you know, in the hundreds out of hundreds of thousands of sites. So, but do you have any better statistics about adoption?
Yeah, we have a few billion pages in web. Most of the people who have adopted it are the bigger websites, and these are the ones who adopted first, and they don't run Drupal and things like that, and they don't really advertise too much, and we also don't advertise it too much.
Well, so are we talking about thousands of sites or hundreds of thousands or millions or what?
Thousands of sites, probably tens of thousands.
That's pretty small.
Probably more like thousands. It's all a matter of, you know, you can measure it as whichever way you want. Technically, there's 10 million, tens of millions of registered domains, most of which aren't active. There's tens, and number of, I mean, sites is not a very meaningful measure. What we like to look at is the number of pages and the number of pages which get any non-zero traffic in any week.
As a fraction of the entire web, it sounds like it's incredibly tiny.
We have no idea how big the entire web is, maybe.
Come on, if anybody does, you know.
Yes, and we don't know. That is the point.
Well, you have some idea.
It's the hundreds or billions of pages. We don't know. Every time we extend our crawl capabilities, we find them. So it's really, really, really large, even after excluding sort of the repeated pages and so on. And a lot of it is just sort of dark matter, which is probably not even worth looking at. But in terms of, like, look, the major sites like Yelp and IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes and this and this and this, this is like, it's pretty much all of them are either doing it or planning on doing it shortly. And these things,
oh, really?
These things take years to catch on. Based on any metric that we use, it's going, you know, ahead of schedule, if anything.
There are people typing, but no one got their hand up right now. I will offer one comment on the chat that's going on right now. Again, in the standards context that I observe and some of the committees I'm on, that some of the new standards that are being developed are much more aggressively importing pre-existing other standards and, in fact, other, I would say, loosely worded ontologies, if a standard is to be making reference to units, then there's efforts to try and either refer to the ISO standards on units or some other things going on in various countries on units of measure. So I think that's good, and I think it is sort of moving in the direction of what I guess Doug Fox was talking about, the micro-theory kind of approach in Dyke, but is not trying to reinvent the wheel once there are a good set of little chunks of ontologies out there. And I think that's also the whole philosophy behind the Open Ontology Repository, which is ultimately to play that role of a curated set of ontologies that are amenable to reuse in a semantic or context-free as much as possible way, whether it's, you know, friend of a friend for people or, you know, this unit thing, things like that. So I think we are moving in that direction. Okay, I'll get off my soapbox again. Peter Benson, question.
Hey, Steve. Actually, your soapbox was pretty good, and, you know, it's, I think you're going the right direction. The standards are, in fact, trying to do a better job of leveraging each other and bringing these things together. And just part of what I was, you know, or questions or comment is that we're finding that as more and more terminologies are coming to the surface, the issue is about being able to map from one to the other easily. Because, you know, once these groups start down the path of developing their own terminology and their own schemas, you will never stop them. So it's not a question of, and they're actually very hard to even turn any direction. So what we've been finding is much easier just to focus on the mapping solutions between them. If you call it this and I call it that, that's fine. We're just talking about the same thing. Let's just map the two together. So a lot of the work that we've been doing in the industrial and the automation systems and the, has been on these mapping solutions. So I'm just wondering whether you have been looking at that as you approach other organizations. How do you, you mentioned the news feeds. Are you just absorbing their terminology, or are you mapping yours to theirs?
We are working closely with them so that the particular piece of vocabulary that we worked with is a thing called RNews. We worked with them so that they took the portions of RNews that were not already in schema.org, created a version of RNews that was compatible with the rest of schema.org, and just merged it into schema.org. Our goal is not so much to have a complicated set of mappings, etc., but to create a site where if a webmaster says, I have, you know, information about objects of type X, what markup do I do? We don't want to get them into this complicated maze of, well, there is this, and there is this mapping thing, and there is this other body which did this, and you should do this, blah, blah, blah.
No, it's not optimized
for us. It's optimized for the webmaster. So here is a single page where you will find your markup.
Right. No, I don't think there's any doubt that Skim.org should say, if you want to type this stuff for us, here's what to use. But it's helpful to show them if, as you develop your work, you are taking concepts that came or definitions from somewhere else.
Yes,
at
we do, and in fact, we have actually we have a process for that, and there is in fact even a legal document that you have to sign and you submit something to us, and then we mark it up, and then we add the stuff, and then we give attribution on schema.org pages itself. So we do all that stuff.
Okay.
We just send for editors and publishers to bear the cost of that.
Who bears the cost?
So the mainstream culture in the RDF world, in the semantic web world, is to use like 6 or 7 different namespaces all at once. And that pushes the burden down onto publishers, onto webmasters, onto people who don't really want it and can't deal with it. So schema.org instead prepackages a whole bunch of those things. I think that's the right place for the hard work to live. It's better that we do it than the webmasters.
Our interest would be to make sure that the schema.org references are visible to other people, so if they can map their own to that,
yes.
If they have other content that's already mapped, you know, tagged in some way, it's very easy for them to translate it. That's all. So, I mean, that's something the Open Technical Dictionary does very well, and I'd like to see if there's ways we leverage each other in that. Okay.
Okay. We're actually rapidly approaching the 1.5-hour mark, which is the advertised length of this session. So, Peter, were you had a logistics comment or a technical question or what?
I had a question.
Okay.
I would like either Guha or Dan elaborate a little on what is brewing between you guys and Creative Commons, if you can talk about it.
Dan?
I was going to say, I know this is one of your favorite topics, so get crazy.
We're working, the Creative Commons has been funded by the Gates Foundation to create vocabularies for education. And we are working with them in doing that. There's really nothing a whole lot more to add to that at this point.
They have something out for review,
and then we're looking at it right now.
So it's mainly education related, not sort of open or maybe open education related.
Actually, I'm going to post to the channel the link for the 0.5 version of LRMI, it's the Learning Resources Metadata. Anyone here with an interest in education can take a look at that, it's right at a point now where it can change and respond to comments. So now is the right time to review it.
We should wrap up. I'm going to be kicked out of the room in which I am in a conference.
Yes, okay. So I agree. I'm trying to keep us on time as well. So we're 1 minute before the top of the hour here. So I'd just like to really thank Guha and Dan for being willing to make yourselves available for any and all of our questions here. And hopefully we can keep the dialogue going. So
great. Thank you for having us.
Okay.
Yeah, pleasure.
And with that, I will close this call. And thanks, everyone, for coming.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
See you, guys. Thanks.